In 2015, Netflix released a 10-part documentary series, Making a Murderer, that explores the 2005 Manitowoc area homicide of 25-year-old photographer Teresa Hallback and the convictions of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. The series became a true crime cult classic, with each episode averaging 19 million viewers in the US alone in the first 35 days. A lot of viewers were left with an overwhelming sensation that Stephen Avery had been framed. But then in 2023, director Sean Rett created a response piece titled Convicting a Murderer. Today I'm joined by Sean Rett and Brenda Schuler, who features in the series, to discuss documentary ethics and an alternate version of the case against Stephen Avery. Sean and Brenda, thank you for joining me today. We're here to discuss Convicting a Murderer, the 10-part documentary series directed by you, Sean, and that Brenda, you are the supervising producer of, and you also happen to feature in the series. There is a lot for us to unpack today. To set the scene, I describe Convicting a Murderer as an answer piece to the 10-part Netflix documentary series Making a Murderer that came out back in 2015 and became somewhat of a true crime cult classic. To put it in perspective, the series had 19 million viewers in the US in the first 35 days. For anyone who hasn't watched Making a Murderer, it explores the 2005 Manitowoc area homicide of 25-year-old photographer Teresa Hallback and the subsequent convictions of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. Before we do get down to the nitty-gritty, on a personal level, and I'll start with you, Brenda, I know you're from Manitowoc County. What's your backstory when it comes to this case in particular?
I'm actually from a different county. I'm about an hour away from Manitowoc County. I was aware of Stephen Avery prior to Making a Murderer and his 1985 wrongful conviction and his 2003 exoneration, but I didn't know a real lot about the case until Making a Murderer. And after I watched Making a Murderer, I reached out to the assistant district attorney from Manitowoc County and just wanted to get some information. I was trying to reach out to anybody that would talk to me. And I ended up kind of helping him with his book, just doing some fact-checking in 2016. And through that process, I met Andy Colburn, who was the Manitowoc County officer featured in Making a Murderer. I interviewed him for Michael Griesbach's book. And then once that was published, Andy Colburn asked if I wanted to talk to Tom Fassbender. And he's the lead detective. So of course, I was absolutely thrilled to be able to do that and ended up helping the prosecutor from Calumet write his book, which was Ken Kratz. And then throughout that process, I met Sean.
Back when the case first happened with Stephen Avery and Teresa Hallback was missing, what was the general sentiment in your community and the surrounding areas?
Everybody was following the trial pretty closely, and it was in the news a lot simply because of his exoneration 2 years prior, which had also been in the news quite a bit. So the general feeling was just that it was everywhere. I don't recall ever hearing Andy Colburn or James Link's name or anything like that until Making a Murderer. So it wasn't that we were all thinking, oh, he was framed. I believe pretty much early on from the get-go with the Teresa murder that he was guilty.
Of Teresa's murder. For anyone who doesn't know about the exoneration that happened with Stephen Avery, can you just explain that for us as well?
Sure. In 1985, Stephen was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault of a woman named Penny, and he went to prison for that. There wasn't any DNA evidence. It was really based upon eyewitness identification and probably some oversight in the officers at the time, Manitowoc County, that was investigating that case. It wasn't until 2003 that they finally were able to run DNA tests that resulted in not only exonerating Stephen Avery, but also inculpating Gregory Allen, who was the actual perpetrator. So Avery was exonerated for that sexual assault. It was on a beach in Manitowoc County.
And that was in 2003 that he was exonerated. And then it was only 2 years later in 2005 that it all exploded again with Teresa Hallback.
Exactly.
You mentioned that you had a connection to the lead prosecutor in Avery's case, Ken Kratz. Now, you were a fact checker, was it, for his book?
Yes.
That book was titled Avery, The Case Against Stephen Avery and What Making a Murderer Gets Wrong. Now, Brenda, I wanted to ask you, how do you respond to the argument that you were just a supporter of Ken Kratz and his message and therefore unable to provide unbiased coverage of the case?
Well, I feel like I did a lot of legwork on this. After Making a Murderer, I was fortunate enough to live close enough to the area that I could go research. So I went to the library in Manitowoc. I was one of the first people collecting public records at Manitowoc Clerk of Courts. I kind of inserted myself wherever I could to get information because for some reason, Making a Murderer really drove me to research this case. I wanted the truth. So I've always said that I think Stephen Avery is guilty. I think that we have been very transparent about the fact that I think that. I've never removed anything from social media after going on record with Sean or doing the documentary. I think a lot of people could be biased. It's okay to have some type of bias when you're doing it. You just have to do it fairly, is kind of how I look at it. And I felt like I went above and beyond to be fair about it because I cross-referenced. Sean actually required that everything we cited had to have at least two citations supporting it. I felt that we were very careful because we knew that this would probably be one of the most scrutinized documentaries ever, simply because what we were doing was sort of unprecedented. We were doing a rebuttal to another documentary that we thought was unfairly representing the officers of Manitowoc County. And not only that, but Teresa's family members and a lot of the Wisconsin Crime Lab officers, analysts, whatnot. So I felt like it was something that we really needed to do to make sure that we represented these people fairly was to do our due diligence. So I'm very confident with the output. I've always said that if anybody wanted me to prove something in the film, I feel like I could do that with my supporting documentation.
We'll get into all of that in just a moment. Sean, to go over to you now, Convicting a Murderer isn't your first rodeo. You've directed White Boy, Murder in the Park, and the American Gospel series, to name a few that I personally have watched. How did you get into documentary making in the first place? And why the focus on true crime?
Well, I wanted to be a scripted filmmaker eventually. I started this pretty old. I started at about 43 years old in this business. And the stars aligned in a way that my partner, Ralph McGreevy, and I, he's the one who helped me start the company. His next door neighbor ran Crime Stoppers. And they, at the time, were looking for a local TV show, that, like a half hour, that could run every week. And that was the first thing we ever produced. And it got great ratings and won Emmy Awards and performed really well, but didn't make a lot of money. And I said, well, I'm going to try it. The film route. And the sponsor of the Chicago Crime Stoppers program was an attorney named Andrew Hale, who often represented police officers who were accused of wrongdoing. And he said, what do you want to make documentaries about? I said, I heard Texas executed an innocent man. You know, his house caught on fire. And I told him the story. He said, I have one that's much better than that. He goes, but it's a very, very hard story to tell because it's a double wrongful conviction. This guy was wrongfully convicted by an innocence project. And that was stunning to me, but I saw that as a huge challenge. So that's when we set out to make a Murder in the Park. I hate to spoil it, but I have to brag a little bit. It resulted in not only our subject being released from prison, but him receiving a settlement from the university and from some other individuals involved. And then when I learned the business of film, I learned that, you know, there are things called mandates that agencies send out. They'll say, no more cupcakes, no more pit bulls. They want big personalities and rags to riches stories. I never saw a mandate sheet say no true crime. So it's what they call an evergreen genre. So for the sake of business, I thought, well, it's probably pretty smart to stay in this lane.
If we could now go back to Making a Murderer, it was promoted as a social justice documentary that held a mirror up to the criminal justice system and leaves us as viewers with the impression that this case in particular involved a tremendous miscarriage of justice, alluding to Avery and Dassey's innocence. Now, this, of course, led viewers to respond with universal outrage about the verdicts. I know you both watched it when it aired. Brenda, you've kind of touched on your initial response, but can you explain again, when you finished the last episode of the series, what did you believe and what questions were you left with?
Raquel, after I watched Making a Murder, actually throughout Making a Murder, thinking I knew everything about the case as far as his guilt or innocence, for a day or so, I had some doubts. But I would say to my husband after each episode, what is going on? You know, I don't remember any of this. Now, I wasn't as invested in 2005, 6, 7, but after watching Making a Murder just drove my curiosity to the point of obsession, quite frankly. And that night, I started a Facebook group. I started researching. There was very little online, but I had more questions than anything. Like, I didn't really understand what was going on. Like, how could I be so confused when I thought I knew this case? You know, to some degree, I thought I knew this case. And after watching it, I, like I said, I was just kind of more or less taken aback. I thought it was brilliantly done, the film itself. It left me with a lot of questions that I wanted answers to. And that's probably the first time that I ever questioned his guilt.
Sean, from the perspective of a documentary maker, what were your observations?
I heard all the hype and I was a Netflix subscriber, you know, since they got past the DVD business, and I love Netflix, but I didn't watch it when it originally came out. But what happened was, you know, we had just released right around the same time, A Murder in the Park, which was really well accepted and critically acclaimed. Making a Murder was really the first true crime binge. That and The Jinx were the first two bingeable true crime series. And a bunch of articles kept popping up. I mean, a lot of them saying, if you want more of a true crime fix, here's a list of things to watch. You know, watch The Thin Blue Line, watch The Staircase. Well, we were often on that list. So I'm getting my reports from IFC, who bought A Murder in the Park and put it on Netflix and Showtime. And all of a sudden, our sales and our rentals are going way up. And I couldn't understand why. And then the reason was Making a Murder. So I said, I better watch this thing. So when I watched it, first of all, I loved that they broke so many rules. You know, I was taught a scene can't be longer than, you know, a minute and a half or whatever. I had all these rules. They had like 7, 9 minute courtroom scenes, you know. I love that they broke the rules and everybody still watched it and loved it. And I will tell you that at the end, A, I thought something stunk and I thought there may have been a conspiracy and something may have been wrong. But B, I just couldn't understand why they didn't close the loop on that blood vial. It was so powerful, and I just didn't, it's like, is something still pending? I'm Googling, trying to follow up, you know, what happened with the blood vial? I find a New Yorker article that says, oh, the blood vial was a non-issue, and they knew it when they were editing this movie. And I, at that moment, I said, somebody is going to make the mother of all answer movies or series for this, and I can't wait to watch it. I had my popcorn ready. A year and a half later, Andy Hale, that same attorney I told you about, was approached by Ken Kratz, who said, we were trying to make a movie and can't get it off the ground. And Ken had a lot of ideas about how he wanted to make. And I said, well, first of all, if I'm involved, you're not. You know, you don't have final cut. I'm doing this the way I want to do this.
So you maintain creative control over the whole project?
Yes, final cut and creative control over the whole project. So they agreed to that. It took a while. There's their mistrust of media. And we put it all in writing and inked the deal. And then he said, by the way, you know, nobody knows more about this than Brenda. So I had to make sure that Brenda was involved in the project. What you're seeing is a result of Brenda's work when you watch this project. I mean, this is just her mission. She didn't have to do this. This is just, she left Wisconsin and came to Cleveland, Ohio to our offices for years, off and on, to get this done. And it was just, I've never seen so much work. Compared to our other films, I mean, we've never spent 6 years and millions of dollars like this.
It was a remarkably well done production, I will say that. And as you said, 6.5 years in the making, it ultimately culminates into the series Convicting a Murderer. Sean, you mentioned that it was blackballed by Hollywood. Why?
Because everybody's moving around right now. All the buyers are playing musical chairs and they're all friends. You know, who's getting bigger and who's getting smaller and who's consolidating? If you're a buyer at Hulu or if you're a buyer at Roku or if you're a buyer at A&E, there's a chance one day you're going to want to work at Netflix. Okay. And do you want to be the one who showed the whole world how they, we allege, intentionally misled the public? You know, they were reckless and they were, you know, used narrative filmmaking techniques because their algorithms mattered more than the truth. And it's not a very popular thing. So our agents wouldn't represent the film. Agents who said that we were permanent clients, but they co-produce with Netflix. So I understand. Our aggregator wouldn't put it on iTunes and Amazon because they're Netflix's lab. I went to one of the biggest documentary agents in Hollywood, had a meeting, and he was honest with me. He said, dude, I have to work in this town. So this was a hot potato. And everybody agreed that, yes, there are 100 million people waiting to watch this. And yes, you definitely have a story to tell because they kind of messed up the original. But they're like, someone else is going to have to do it. And we're really thankful that the Daily Wire, you know, whatever they are, they had the guts to step up and do this and take it on and put it out there.
Now, Daily Wire catches the hot potato. We know that Daily Wire is known for being politically and socially conservative. Did the reputation of Daily Wire concern either of you?
No, it concerned some of our staff, some of our liberal staff. They took their names off the titles, but I'm a Daily Wire subscriber. I have been since they started. So I think Brenda and I both lean to the right, but I don't think there's anything political about this story. The two camps, okay, are guilters and truthers. Guilters are people who believe Stephen's guilty. Truthers are people who believe that they were framed or that something's wrong, something's amiss. There are conservatives and liberals among both groups. So I don't think this cuts along political lines at all. The Daily Wire, their comment to me was, we know this isn't about politics, but we love exploring culture. And this is about culture. So I think that's the reason they took it on. And they love controversy, obviously.
It sells. Controversy sells. And for you, Brenda, it didn't concern you, Daily Wire's reputation?
No, not at all. I was actually very happy that they took it on because I knew that Candace Owens was not going to be afraid to speak out about it. And that's really what it needed for people to really pay attention to what the film Making a Murder was about so they could see how egregiously the editing was and how it affected so many people, the collateral damage caused by this. And because other people were afraid to do it, and they were actually very pleasant. Candace was very pleasant to work with, so.
I would say you mentioned you both kind of lean politically to the right. I would say I lean quite radically to the left. And so when I saw Daily Wire and then Candace Owens, I had this knee-jerk reaction initially. And I thought, to be honest, that it was going to be a politically motivated piece. So I was really surprised going through the whole series, all 10 parts of it, to find that, hang on a minute, it's not at all. And as you say, Sean, it actually speaks a lot more to culture, which is very interesting. I was wondering about the choice to star Candace Owens, because she does feature in the documentary, but she doesn't appear as much as I thought she would. And when she does, she doesn't really say anything majorly controversial. At times, I was wondering why she was in it. So Sean, from a creator's perspective, why did you choose to feature Candace Owens?
When they came to us, they said from the beginning that this is three quarters done. It's got to be on brand. Being on brand means making it political or putting one of their talents in it, okay? So I knew whoever did it is going to take a lot of gunfire, all right, figuratively speaking. And they chose the person who loves being fired at, and I thought she would be the right person. I agreed with them. And then we went from there. And she changed it some. I consider filmmaking artistry. So there are times when we like disorienting the audience a little bit and then letting them figure it out and come to a conclusion. As Daily Wire reworked it, a lot of times they're like, well, the conclusion's this, just say it. It changed the project. It removed, you know, some of the artistry. They did want to put their mark on it and kind of change the order in which the story was told and where we drop certain bombs.
When I think about right-wing views on crime and justice, the things that come to mind are law and order, personal responsibility, and politicians saying we need to be tough on crime. What are your views when it comes to crime and punishment?
Well, I'm very left when it comes to the criminal justice system. I'm for criminal justice reform. I'm against the death penalty. That's where I go left. I don't think that we're paying enough for prisoners to be reformed. I think that people complain that we spend $30,000 a year on a prisoner. I think we should be spending about $80,000. I think that there should be more isolation, more trades, more teaching. Getting the tablets in the prisons was a good move. It's cut the violence profoundly. The fighting, people are just kind of watching, you know, watching Freevee in their bunk and not worried about politics in the prison with all that time on their hands. Tough on crime is a get me elected jingle. Bill Clinton did it, and regrets it immensely, apologized in a speech for it, and cost many, many, many people of color their lives, you know, or portions of their lives with that crime bill. There's two approaches to everything. There's this purest right-wing approach of, hey, cut welfare, and they'll have to learn to do it on their own. And it's like, okay, that sounds great at 30,000 feet. But if you were on the ground seeing the suffering, you couldn't say that. So there's nuances. My movie White Boy addresses that quite a bit. Lawmakers didn't know what to do about crack. So they came up with these draconian laws and these like edicts that someone's going to get life in prison. And that, like, as if it's going to deter someone from making $1,800 in 20 minutes. It's not. They're still going to do it. It's just they're going to worry more when they do it. So the answer is a balance, okay, a cultural balance, more opportunity, more grants for people in the city to start businesses. If you're talking about crime in the inner city, they're just entrepreneurs. You know, they have a supplier, they have a markup, they have security, they have territories, you know, which is basically franchises. I mean, it's like they're running a McDonald's, but they have to look over their shoulder every minute. I'm going to make films about that one day. I don't know if they'll make any money, but I'm going to try and change hearts and minds.
If Making a Murderer seeks to reveal the shortcomings of the criminal justice system, what then does Convicting a Murderer seek to reveal?
The shortcomings of documentary filmmaking ethics.
Is any part of that designed to vindicate the reputations of the justice professionals involved in the case?
I personally felt terrible for Andrew Colburn. You know, other people involved in this have gone over and above to be unliked with things they've done publicly. But Andrew Colburn, I see as a victim. His life is decimated. And so, yes, a part of me certainly wanted to clear Andrew Colburn's name, Tom Fassbender's name. By the way, these guys, I hate to tell you, they don't all get along. So I don't know how they're holding a conspiracy together when, you know, they don't enjoy each other's company. I don't know if I've said that in any other interviews, but I can promise you there's no conspiracy. If there were, somebody would have used it against somebody else.
Look, for me, Convicting a Murderer, it shows how easy it is to fool people and then how difficult it becomes to convince people that they were fooled once they've made up their mind. Brenda, please talk to me about the conversations that you were having with people who identified as truthers.
Well, the first thing I would say about truthers is there's a much different personality when you're on Reddit, on X, than if you meet these people in real life. And I think the one thing that I learned, and I've met truthers and guilters, the one thing that I've learned is that there's a lot of passion there. But the sad thing is that we could agree on 99% of the things in the world. But the fact that the Stephen Avery case, we have different opinions on, we have to be mean to each other online. There's just zero conversation of any type. But when I did the interviews with the truther, several of them, Christine and Megan, the two girls, and then, of course, Foul Play, I enjoyed all of them. I enjoyed talking to every single one of them. But it was very interesting that it's like they were waiting almost for me to finish my sentence so they could answer it. So it was hard because I didn't feel that really either side was open-minded to listening to each other. And, you know, even though I was showing proof and talking about proof, It was always, but what about this? But what about this? And it became difficult from that aspect. But I remember some very interesting moments that I had with some of the truthers that just made me feel like, you know, they're human too. Everybody's human. They all put their pants on the same way. So why can't we all just talk about this and have differing opinions? And of course, that's, you know, on a bigger scale, that's a lot of the topics in the whole world right now. But it's just frustrating because I think nobody wants to try and understand. Everybody just digs their feet in and doesn't want to consider the other side. But I don't know. It's been a great experience from that standpoint, to be honest, to really get to understand how they think and truthers and guilters and just how seeing it. I really feel through this process, I've seen a different side of humanity. And I said that in episode 10. Because of the things that people weren't afraid to say while they're anonymous online or do, you know, doxing people and tweeting about Teresa's family, all of those things have just, I didn't think anything like that could happen. I really didn't think people could be that cruel.
Well, that's really quite a beautiful insight that you had.
It's a bittersweet, I would say, the whole process, for sure.
I left Teresa's family out of the list of people who were hurt by this, and I shouldn't have. They were terribly hurt by a lot of the things that were said and implied, and they were just awful, awful allegations.
It really is disastrous when you get, as you said, on Reddit and see how people talk about this case with no regard for humanity or people involved or how these families are dealing with such a traumatic event. Unfiltered will be back shortly. Thank you for supporting us by listening to this episode's sponsors. Thank you for listening to this episode's ads. By supporting our sponsors, you support Unfiltered to continue to deliver quality content. I think it is time now to get down to the nitty-gritty, the evidence. Laura Ricciardi and Moira Demos, the creators of Making a Murderer, have been accused of cherry-picking evidence to fit the story that they wanted to portray. I thought we could break down the revelations we witness in Convicting a Murderer in two parts. Firstly, with the evidence Making a Murderer emphasizes to cast doubt on Avery and Dassey's guilt. And then secondly, the evidence omitted by the same series. Let's get into it. Let me choose to start with the $36 million lawsuit that was hanging over Manitowoc County at the time. Brenda, talk us through that.
There was a lawsuit based upon Stephen's exoneration for the wrongful conviction in 1985. So he filed a lawsuit for $36 million against Manitowoc County and the former district attorney and the former sheriff. And that lawsuit in Making a Murderer was really kind of the foundation for the motive to frame Stephen. It kind of set the stage. Why? Because, of course, you have to have motive to do something that terrible to frame a person, an innocent person. So the $36 million was a really, really big deal. And in Making a Murderer, they show one of the press conferences that was later in the week. And we learned that elected officials recused themselves. They showed that there also was somebody that was with them. So it was kind of confusing. It's like, well, are they recused or not? So I think that we cleared that up to say, well, first of all, this was Manitowoc's decision. No one came in and said, oh, you guys have to hand this over to Calumet. This was Manitowoc's decision due to the perception of conflict of interest. And as a result, all of the elected officials recuse themselves. So I think the $36 million is easily rebutted simply because it's Manitowoc that made that decision to recuse elected officials and above. You know, there really wasn't anything to lose. And the fact that Colburn and Link were made to be like the main planters of evidence because of this lawsuit, well, you know, they weren't even there in 1985, and Making a Murderer more or less showed that they were worried because they were being deposed. Well, they cut out the fact that they were witnesses. They don't say that they weren't defendants. They weren't defendants. They had nothing to lose, and the time frame to add them as defendants had already passed. So there was really nothing to worry about, but yet that was the big foundation that viewers perceived as, you know, why? Why would officers do that? Well, because they couldn't afford the $36 million. You know, that's why. And he wouldn't have gotten $36 million. That was a very difficult case to prove. You have to prove malicious intent.
How many law enforcement officials would have had to be involved in framing Stephen Avery? It wasn't just two people. It would have to involve all of these different departments coming together, making a mastermind plan of framing this guy.
It's the Occam's razor thing again. I mean, what makes more sense, really, if you look at all of the evidence and who would have to do that? And we sat down early on in the process to kind of figure out how you look at each piece of evidence. If we were looking at the case and trying to decide Stephen Avery was framed, how would that look? And I think the minimum number of people, and we didn't even get through all of the evidence, was six that you would need, six to eight that you would need to plant or be involved or keep it a secret or the crime lab or whatnot, right? But yet people online will just say, well, yeah, they just speculate that because somebody found the first bone that, oh, he's involved. Well, all of a sudden you have this massive conspiracy, but nobody can give us a real clear outline with each piece of evidence how it got there with only one or two people. There's no way.
It's interesting because I think sometimes Hollywood has served as somewhat of an injustice when it comes to how we understand true crime is happening. I think we simplify from our couches and think, oh, this is definitely possible. And really, it's not.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they wanted to create classic heroes and villains. The heroes were Stephen's attorneys who actually went on tour after making a murderer and capitalized on their popularity and how they were portrayed. But if you watch the way they answer some of the questions, they seemed somewhat uncomfortable with it. You know, I think they knew in their heart of hearts that, I mean, they were correcting people. They corrected people on the blood vial. They were like, oh no, it was just the phlebotomist who put the blood in it. You know, I'm sorry, I keep going back to the blood vial, but that was like the biggest deal to me when I watched that program. We have some of Netflix's notes and they literally were like, called the police the baddies. They wanted more ominous music behind the baddies. They kept reusing reaction shots that made people look like they were up to something. I think that a big problem here was using classic Hollywood and narrative filmmaking techniques with something that's real life and leaving people in your wake, you know, with damaged lives.
When we go back to the evidence that Making a Murderer focused on, another piece of evidence is the key to Teresa Hallback's car. What can you tell me about that discovery? Because I know it's a big thing that people are talking about.
Well, what I can tell you is that Ken Kratz stated, and I think I agree with him, that he would have got his conviction without that key. So if something nefarious happened there, yes, it's a horrible sign. We can't disprove their theory, but it wasn't needed to make this case. So I'm sort of neutral on this subject. I don't think the police planted it, but I also think it's dishonest how Making a Murderer acted as if they looked for that key six or seven times when they went in there for very specific purposes each time. Go in there and get those guns. Go in there and inventory the porn. Go in there and look for Teresa, you know, was the very first one. They had specific goals when they went in there. They didn't scour the place inch by inch, six or seven times. Is it weird how it ended up there? Yeah. Do I think law enforcement officers planted it? No.
Like Sean said, it's difficult to really say. I lean more towards it wasn't planted simply because it's ridiculous how it ended up there. It's, you know, truth is stranger than fiction is kind of how I look at it. And actually, that was the one thing after Making a Murderer that I could not figure out and gave me the doubt I had. That was the one thing that just was like, how did that happen? But I would lean more towards it wasn't simply because it's so strange that if you were framing him, you're just not going to set it someplace you just were looking. So
why not put it behind those books? Why not just put it in the cabinet, pull out the books and take the picture?
Yeah, right.
Why have it out in the open?
And have Kaharsky find it, not them.
So many questions. Now, I would say for me, the most egregious misconduct shown in the documentary Making a Murderer concerns Brendan Dassey and the tactics used in the police interrogation. For a bit of context, he's Stephen Avery's 16-year-old nephew at the time. He's deficient in his cognitive abilities and ends up confessing to being a party to first-degree murder, mutilation of a corpse, and second-degree assault. This is where, at least for me, I felt the strongest sense that a miscarriage of justice had taken place. I guess I felt sympathy towards Brendan Dassey, and I know a lot of other people did. Let's unpack Brendan's confession and the tactics used in the police interrogation.
I'll start, but Brenda knows much more about this than I do. The interviews, me personally, they grossed me out. I recognize the techniques. You know, they call it the Reed technique and the superior knowledge theory. We already know they're the same techniques that people use to sell timeshares. It's salesmanship. And I think it's gross, but it's totally accepted practice. It's held up in court. They made it look like everything was suggested. And they didn't show things that Brendan volunteered. And he volunteered an awful lot of information. The detectives up north, when they were talking to Brendan said to them, "Do you think Stephen did it?" And they said, "Did what?" And he said, "Raped her." Well, they hadn't found Teresa at that point. They didn't know anything that was going on. So that right there is a big giveaway, a big tell that he knew an awful lot more than he was saying. That's my take on it. Brenda can probably get into a lot more detail.
There's a lot of different angles on Brendan, and I think just showing the parts in Making a Murder that they showed and leaving out some of the more detailed information, I think two things that Brendan answered for me after Making a Murder that helped me lean more towards him being involved was, why was Teresa's blood in the back of the Rav if they burned her? You know, I always wonder that. So I had these three questions, like after Making a Murder, the key threw me off. And why were there bones in other locations? That was very confusing to me. And then again, the blood, Teresa's blood in the back of the Rav, like from her hair. Why would she be in there? And reading Brendan's confession in full answered the last two questions for me, was why she was in the back of the Rav, because they were thinking about putting her in the pond. And didn't. They changed their mind and decided to burn her because evidence, it burns quicker per Stephen. We'll get rid of the evidence quicker per Stephen. And why were there bones in other locations, mainly being the burn barrel next door? And Brendan stated that, well, after the fire was done, he was breaking up the bones with a shovel and then took the bigger pieces and put them somewhere else. And so he literally answered those two questions for me, and that really kind of solidified it for me. And the thing that I go back and forth on is how big his role was. And the part that really resonated with me was when they asked him, why? What's your motive, right? Why? And he said, because he wanted to know what sex felt like. That to me just felt really raw and really real. And, you know, that just wouldn't be an answer I don't think you'd make up, to me anyway. So if anything, I look at it as more of an involuntary, maybe, confession versus a false confession.
Right. And I guess the question that was always rotating around my mind was his culpability in it. I tended to believe that he was involved in it. I believed his accounts. I was just, because of his cognitive deficiencies and his age at the time, that's what really hung in my mind, was how culpable is this kid?
Anybody with a good heart, it hurts us to believe that this all happened. Were it not for Stephen Avery, would Brendan Dassey have ever participated in anything like this? Of course not. So in that sense, it's terrible that he's wasting away in prison. But he did know right from wrong. He said it himself. I would have gotten in trouble. And it's possible he had a chance to save her life while it was still happening. His mother even said, "You could have been the hero. You could have called 911. And he said, "But I would have gotten in trouble too." So as Teresa's friend says he was the one person who could have saved her. And he's the reason my friend's dead. So that's a pretty powerful line.
It really, really is. If we move on now to the evidence making a murderer omits. In convicting a murderer, we learn that Stephen Avery had a well-established pattern of abusing women and children, as well as animals. I think Candace Owens says every single choice the filmmakers of Making a Murderer made appeared to reduce the knowledge of Stephen Avery's history. What can you tell us about Stephen Avery's history of abusing women, children, and animals?
I can start by saying that I don't necessarily consider it evidence in this case. I consider it a paradigm through which you need to understand who this man is when you look at the later evidence. So this, it's not supposed to say, oh, he was horrible to people and he raped his niece. That doesn't make him a murderer, but it's not Stevie stole a cheese sandwich, which is how Making a Murderer portrayed him. So you have to look at this through the correct lens of who this person is, someone who's has an inability to defer gratification, someone willing to hurt others, and somebody who's so narcissistic that they, you know, might believe later that they could get away with an escalated crime, something even more severe. It is interesting that the filmmakers, when confronted with individual pieces of information like that, they cite brevity as their reason for taking it out. Well, we couldn't make a, you know, 40-hour series. Well, the fact is, it's just very odd that everything they took out would have made Stephen look worse. That's kind of my backdrop on it is, yes, we spent a few episodes on what they left out about his background. That's evidence of who he was. It's not evidence that he killed anybody. But Brenda can get into that a lot more.
My only thing to add on that is the one thing that I found really unfair was how Stephen explained everything. And they let him explain everything. That's fine. It's his story. That's great. But the Sandra Morris case is the one that upsets me probably the most, simply because Sandra Morris needed to be the bad person, the one that he ran off the road. And the way that they edited her deposition footage to make it appear that she was the villain, she was going around and drinking and telling people, talking badly about Stephen. And the way they pieced these sentences together to really make you feel for Stephen and think she was the most horrible person ever. She made this up. It's always blaming the other party. And it's almost like they went along with that and thought that was okay. Because Stephen can tell them one thing. He can tell them about the cat, but you can go get the police reports and see what actually happened.
What actually happened?
Well, they said that he just threw it over the fire, right? Friends were goofing around and he was hanging around with the wrong friends and they threw the cat over the fire and it lit up. Well, then it comes out per the police reports that it was Stephen's idea. It was his cat. He chased the cat around the yard. He caught the cat, poured gas and oil on it, and then told another guy to throw it in the fire. And they leave all of that out. And then everybody will come back and say, but he's not the one that threw it in the fire. So we literally show how, well, yeah, once the cat jumped out, he threw it back in the fire. Making a Murderer had, it does affect how people look at Stephen Avery and how they defend him. But they always made it seem like he was given the benefit of the doubt, but nobody else was. And it wasn't just that it was his story. It was how they edited that story to make the other person look bad. Just tell the story.
As you were saying before, Sean, just because someone has a history of abuse doesn't necessarily make them a murderer. But in any form of storytelling, it's vital to explore the context behind how acts eventually take place. I'm very passionate about that. What really rocked me is, I think you mentioned before, at the time, Stephen was having sexual relations with his niece, Marie. She was 17, he was 43. So of course, that constitutes child sex abuse. His other niece, Kayla, also reported Stephen touching her inappropriately. And you mentioned Brendan Dassey does as well.
There are recorded conversations where Brendan's mother reminds him, well, Brendan reminds his mother how Stephen used to touch them in ways they don't like and mentioned another young male who he touched, another young female who he touched. I mean, it's on a recorded prison phone line. I mean, is that part of the conspiracy? Who was there baiting that information out of them? There weren't any detectives using the Reed technique then. That was a mother and son having a conversation about oral family history. Some of that was included in Making a Murderer, but why not include more of that so you know who this person actually is?
Shortly after I finished watching Making a Murderer, I specifically remember watching an interview with Stephen's ex-fiance, Jody. And in this interview, she states that she absolutely believed that Stephen committed the murder of Teresa. And she also said that if it wasn't Teresa, she feared it would have been her. Do you remember watching that interview?
I do. It was on HLN. I remember a lot of that interview. I remember being excited to watch that when the teasers were out that it was coming on because she was one person I wanted to know how she felt at that time, years later. I think she probably regrets doing that interview, to be honest, because the amount of hatred from Stephen's supporters, I just can't even understand. I mean, we reached out to her. We've had people reach out to her and she said, I don't want to do it again. I don't want to go on camera. I can't. And that's too bad because I would have loved to talk to her, but we certainly had enough information just from the police records. And we didn't even share a lot of that in the film. Obviously, people think we included all of his past history. We didn't. There's more. But Jody, as far as Jody, I mean, she took rat poison to try to commit suicide just to get to the hospital, to get away from him. I mean, I do think in the phone calls, listening to the phone calls, that she did think that she was in love with him, but they fought like cats and dogs. In the interview, it was kind of what I would have expected her to say for someone that had been through that and now kind of gotten away from it and was able to move on with their life.
Something I noticed about Stephen's niece, about his ex-fiance, about Candy Avery, who was Earl's wife, Earl's ex-wife, is that they all seemed to have a form of Stockholm syndrome. And as much as they played the game and supported him and said the right things to the original filmmakers, but once they got out of there, which they weren't sure they could do, but once they got out of that situation, then we're free to talk. It's like you understand that, like, it's almost like a family mafia. And, you know, you had to toe the party line while you're there. Because they're like, oh, she's saying two different things, so she's a liar, she's not credible. No, I think that everybody, when they're in that family, is under an awful lot of duress, the worst being Brendan, who should be free right now, but Grandpa called him and pressured him into rejecting a plea deal that would have gotten him out before he was middle-aged. I do think that there's a lot of Stockholm syndrome involved with a lot of these folks.
And that's not uncommon in situations of abuse for people to protect the image of their abuser initially until they feel safe enough to do otherwise. I mean, you can read up on many cases of that happening. So people changing their story years later isn't a sign that they're lying now, but perhaps they were lying out of fear in the past.
Yeah, I agree. You're right.
Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey, they were convicted of murdering Teresa Holbach. That was in 2007, I believe. We're now in November 2023. Where do the cases of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey currently stand? Are they appealing? What's happening?
Sure. Both of them who have gone through the appeals process, Stephen has been going through them for years. And after Making a Murder came out, Kathleen Zellner took the case for Stephen and she's been filing motions. He's been denied by the circuit court and the appellate court ever since. It's currently at the appellate level. They are waiting for Kathleen Zellner to file an additional motion. As far as Brendan, unless there's new evidence that comes along, the Supreme Court denied or rejected hearing his case. So he doesn't have anything pending right now at all.
Look, the final episode of Convicting a Murderer was by far my favorite because it delves into documentary ethics, which is such an important yet under-discussed topic of conversation. There is a lot to this. One of the shut the front door moments I had as a viewer was when you expose how the creators of Making a Murderer strategically edit and distort interviews and transcripts to fit their version of events. I'm specifically thinking about the courtroom here. Can you elaborate on that, perhaps, Sean?
Well, it started with them just using the same reaction shots, which may not have crossed the ethical line. That could just be lazy filmmaking, not taking the effort to find a better reaction shot. I would have just used the actual reaction. I don't know why you wouldn't, but that was like at the line. And then then all of a sudden, we took them to the line. Then I'm like, now we're going to blow everybody past the line. And we show where they had him answering a question that was never answered in court. They literally changed history and acted as if he answered a question in which there was an objection from the special prosecutor and he never answered the question. And that's when you realize the lengths that they'll go, and they go to far greater lengths than that, to manipulate the emotions of the viewer. You can't defend it. It's undefendable. And it's like, oh, people, they say people can question our process. Well, that's not a process. That's just deviant and destructive and intentionally misleading. It's amazing to me how they won their defamation case, but they did. The court found in Netflix's favor and the filmmaker's favor, but I don't know how they made that finding given all the information of what they intentionally did.
I just wanted to add one thing, since it kind of hits on Sean's topic that he's talking about with the Colburn lawsuit. One of the things the filmmaker said in that lawsuit was the reason that they showed that footage was because they didn't have any footage of the judge or Colburn or anyone answering it or the objection or anything like that. And that was actually in the judge's order of dismissal that they used different footage because they didn't have that footage. And we didn't comment on it. But as you can see clearly in our film, the footage exists because we showed it.
That was media pool footage that they had access to. I'm sorry to interrupt. That was media pool footage that they had full access to. And I can't imagine they missed recording and downloading every second of that trial. I just fail to believe they missed any of it.
Recently, I interviewed a retired NCIS detective, and he said the biggest mistake most people make when it comes to investigating crimes or investigative journalists in this case is that they'll have their story and then they'll find whatever they can to make evidence fit into the story that they already have in their mind. And when I was watching Convicting a Murderer, doing my own research into Making a Murderer, that phrase really resonated with me. The problem here is, as viewers, when we watch documentaries, we assume that we're watching the truth being told. But Sean, I guess my question is, what rules of procedure are documentary makers actually bound by to tell the truth? And who are they answerable to?
I think until recently, it was implicit that when you watch a documentary, you're watching real life. You're watching facts. When someone changes it to the degree that the filmmakers did of Making a Murderer, you can't call it a docuseries. It's just not. It's called a Franken-edit. That's the term in the industry. And it's no better than a comedy program taking snippets of people's speeches and making a fake speech. It's no different than some of the things they do for laughs and that they've done on TV for years or on, you know, popular radio shows. The code of ethics I would propose is that you can't engage in activities such as those. You have to say who's paying for the film. You have to say if you have a dog in the fight. You have to disclose if you're an advocate. You know, we're pretty clearly advocating for law enforcement. We've never hidden that, though we give a balanced account, in my opinion. And those disclosures need to be made at the beginning of a film, just like a rating. I watched a great documentary called Divorce Incorporated. I was very moved by it, and then I found out that it was paid for by a men's rights group. So I had to start thinking, did I get the whole story? Because it was an awful story. And, you know, that should have been disclosed. So I think that that some of those rules are in order. They're not going to be exactly the same as the Society of Professional Journalists. There have to be some modifications. But We need that type of voluntary ethical disclosure at the beginning of any documentary or docuseries. Or they need to say, we're not abiding by those ethics. And people need to know that they have to really double check what they're watching.
And they shouldn't be able to win Emmys for editing.
Touché. You also point out that Teresa Halbach, the murder victim, has become less of a person to be remembered and more of a piece in the Stephen Avery narrative. Now, I did a bit of research here and I found a statement that the Halbach family made before episode one of Making a Murderer was released. It's important to note that they declined to be a part of the series. And they say, and I quote here, "Having just passed the 10-year anniversary of the death of our daughter and sister, Teresa, we are saddened to learn that individuals and corporations continue to create entertainment and to seek profit from our loss. We continue to hope that the story of Teresa's life brings goodness to the world." I mean, my heart broke when I read that statement. It obviously makes us question the duty of care filmmakers owe those whose stories they tell. Sean, how do you navigate this territory as a director, considering you two are in many ways rehashing this family's pain for entertainment and profiting off it?
We did not start work until investigator Tom Fassbender met with Teresa's mother and explained the project. And though they had some doubts, they didn't tell us to stop. And we hope, while this probably pulls the scab off again, we hope that this wound heals as much as possible. And, you know, we did make great efforts to clear the family's name from some of these preposterous allegations that were made against her brother and things like that. Where are the mom's tears? Where are the brother's tears? We show their tears. And they're also people of great faith who expect to see their daughter again in heaven. So that has to be considered too. I don't believe in making documentaries unless the subject is on board. And it's really going to be a garbage documentary if the subject is not on board. So it's very important to me to make sure that the person who's the focus of the documentary is okay with us doing it, unless we're exposing something very, very bad.
Final thought, I'm very curious to know, in the process of making Convicting a Murderer, did the creators of Making a Murderer reach out to you guys or try to have a conversation with you?
No, a mutual friend of theirs took me aside, a very powerful person in documentary film, and he said that those women are my friends, and I want you to know that sometimes people get boxed in or painted into a corner. And that's all this individual said. And I don't know if he meant that they were financially painted into a corner and they had to finish this thing because they put their life savings into it, or if he was referring to the Netflix notes that definitely shaped how the filmmakers finished this work. But he was sort of saying there were other factors at work besides the filmmakers. Have some empathy. Don't go so hard on them. And I didn't understand a statement until we got the Netflix notes and saw the Netflix people talking among themselves with the filmmakers not even involved, saying, well, at least they finally have a point of view. Like the filmmakers were this malleable entity that they were shaping into what they wanted, and the project as well.
To finish with a final thought from you, Brenda, at the start, what I really got a sense of is that once you became aware of this case in particular, it became somewhat of your mission, and you play such a key role in the truth-telling aspects in the documentary Convicting a Murderer. Now that it's out in the world and this side of the story has been presented, do you feel a sense that you've accomplished your mission in this case? Can you rest easy, or are you still obsessed with it?
I think I'm still obsessed with it. I think I'm in a little bit of a low-key mode right now, but no, I don't feel like I'm done with it.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Unfiltered with Sean Reck and Brenda Schuler. If you're interested in watching Convicting a Murderer, We've included a link to the series in our show notes.